Thank you. The last bit is just to draw in the audience. Okay. So, not related to my talk at all. Now, this is a mixed audience. So I'll say some things which will be elementary to experts, and some things which will be unintelligible to people from the wrong background. But I'll try to cover both bases. So what this talk is about is looking at quantum gravity. I mean, my interest in Euclidean geometry comes from quantum gravity, and my view has always been, for a long time, and other people also, that any quantum gravity theory, well, it must obtain classical Riemannian geometry or pseudo-Riemannian geometry in some limits, because that's what's got to come out of it. But on the way to that limit, it should pass through non-commutative geometry just because non-commutative geometry is a natural generalization of geometry in which our operators are non-commutative, our coordinates can be non-commutative, and since the effects are coming from quantum gravity, that would be the place, reasonable expectation, that would be the form that the corrections would take. So it is a framework for the next to classical Planck scale effects. It might be the ultimate theory is non-commutative geometry, I'd be very happy if that's the case, but we don't have to know, and we don't have to care. We will still need non-commutative geometry anyway, whether it's string theory or loop variables or anything else. And moreover, even if you don't know the full theory of quantum gravity, you can still use non-commutative geometry, just as you can use topology to classify theta vacua and things in field theory. Even though what you're seeing is a shadow of the true quantum gravity, any classification that you can do within non-commutative geometry or within classical geometry will give you information about the full quantum theory. Now, the approach I'm going to take is one which is a sort of constructive approach, coming out of quantum groups. So the idea is that Lie groups are the best examples of manifolds, of Riemannian manifolds, the starting point in many ways. And we build up things from there, from Rn, from other Lie groups, the homogeneous spaces. So there are things that do occur in the real world, at least if you believe integrable systems, which are quantum groups, and also very natural mathematical properties and applications. So we make those the basis for the symmetries of the theory, or even classical groups for that matter. And then we'll build up the different sets of geometry. So the algebra will be like functions on the set, but then you want to specify differential structure on it. And we'll do that by bimodular differential forms. We'll have quantum principal bundles. And eventually, we might come to the Dirac operator, and then it would tie up with the Lan spectral triple approach. But we're going to go from the ground up. And obviously, we lack powerful theorems that Lan has. But on the other hand, we'll be getting our hands dirty with examples. Now, in this constructive approach, we really want to classify the possibilities, just as when you are thinking about what manifold to take, you've got to know what are the possible manifolds in your model building. So we're going to have, I'm going to do it just to point out to you, there's a lot more than this one. So the Moyar spacetime that was talked about very much on Tuesday is a beautiful example, and so is the non-commutative torus, and they do work well, as we've seen. But in fact, from the algebraic point of view, they are very, very special, and it's because they are co-twist models, and there are a lot of other models in the world of non-commutative geometry available to us, and for which we should see what problems they have. So what about other models? For example, an early model from the 1994 is this one. So the proposal was that space-time and space coordinates and Hankel coordinates don't commute. But this parameter here, this has dimensions of time, so this should be, if it's a quantum gravity effect, then this would be expected to be 10 to the minus 44 seconds. But nevertheless, you can study that geometry and even make predictions from it. Another model is coming out of, well, this is actually related to Roger's talk. I mean, it's a guess, but surely the underlying kind of fuzzy geometry behind the spin network that Roger was pointing to should be this non-commutative space-time. This is angular momentum algebra, but I'm regarding the xi and xj as coordinates of space-time, of space, in this case. Another example from the 90s.
So you have three x?
Yeah, here there are three.
Okay.
Yeah. Another example from the 90s, which was completely worked out, was Q-Minkowski space. So one group in Munich and my group in Cambridge. But my point of view was that these were 2x2 braided Hermitian matrices, a very natural object, also very natural from a twister theory point of view. And we know how to do the integration, differential calculus, propagators, and all of these things on these spaces, but they're incredibly hard to work with because everything is Q-deformed, you need a lot of special functions, etc. And other examples are the quantum groups, and we've seen a very nice talk this morning for using this kind of quantum group technology with this as the fiber of a bundle. Okay, so what problems do these represent? Now, these problems that I'm going to talk about don't show up at the level of the algebra. They don't show up at the level of the universal differential calculus, which is just the algebra. But they show up when you want the real geometry, the geometry that's going to have the right classical limits. So in all these other cases, we actually find an anomaly. And this anomaly, which I call differential anomaly, so that will be the first topic. Well, after space-time, which I'll discuss next, we'll have differential anomaly will be the next topic. There are two ways. This actually is an associativity obstruction. So one way around is to embrace non-associative geometry. So if you like, that's a prediction of the deeper aspects of non-commutative geometry for these examples. But this anomaly vanishes for the Moyar space-time anomaly of torus. You don't see it for them. Or if you really hate non-associative geometry, and some people do, then you can sometimes absorb the anomaly by having extra dimensions. And again, that's what happens in string theory. For example, you have a conformal anomaly, you don't like it, so you add lots of dimensions to the space-time, and then you can neutralize the anomaly. So we do the same thing here. But the extra dimension, the examples that I will show you, could be time, or perhaps, and this is speculative, but we have a paper with Laurent Friedel about this. Renormalization group flow. So somehow there is something being generated by the three-dimensional geometry, or by the non-commutative geometry, an extra dimension being generated, and in some examples it could be time. Okay. Now it was mentioned earlier in this conference about the modular group as a canonical time generated by non-commutative algebra. But that has a lot of other structure for the modular group, and we don't have any of that structure here. So I'm not at all clear that this is at all related, but it would be wonderful if it was. The minimal assumptions for this talk, again, I want to be minimalist because, after all, we are building up from the ground. We don't want to make any assumptions for quantum gravity unless we need to. But the algebra is unital algebra over K, and that's our coordinate algebra. We don't have to assume anything more about it, at least in the first instance. But we will want to have some differential structure. So we'll impose that by simply saying that there is a space of one forms. Now, you can multiply one form from the left or the right. And so we would like to be able to, by function, and AR-like functions. So that means that omega 1 should be an AA bimodule. I do apologize for those who know all of this. Definition is used by everybody who works in the field, so but not everybody here does. Now, D should be an exterior derivative going from a function to a one form. Should obey the Leibniz rule. The omega 1 should be generated by functions in D. And then something which people don't often consider, but I think it's important, is that the kernel of D should be just be the constant functions. And this gives you a restriction. So that corresponds to the manifold being connected. Then you would like to extend, once you've got omega 1, you can usually extend it to higher differentials, to whole exterior algebra of differential forms. And you can do this sometimes canonically, but not always. So that's actually one of the next layer of the model building. But actually, you don't need to worry about that until you need the two forms or until you need the three forms. Okay. Now, we're going to be... Now, of course, a general topological space can have many different differentiable structures, but in the Lie group case, in the case of when you have a Lie group, then that differential structure is actually uniquely determined by translation invariance. So in the same way, we could start by thinking about Hopf algebras, which are or quantum groups. So they have something like group translation. So that's the group product but viewed backwards on the coordinate algebra as a co-product, and that's all I'm going to say about Hopf algebras in this talk. But I'm going to view it as a left and right coaction. So an action is a map going the other way, but the coaction goes, because all the arrows are reversed, goes that way. And so also the calculus will be covariant if this thing extends, this left and right translation extends to, well, left covariant extends to a coaction omega 1 to A tensor omega 1. If you think of A as functions on the group, then this is a group transformation waiting to happen. If you evaluate it on a group function, you'll get an actual transformation from omega 1 to omega 1. That's what a coaction is. On the other side, delta r You can also have that. And if you have both, you say it's bicovariant. If you have both and if they commute, you say it's bicovariant. Now, why do we care about this technical condition, bicovariance? You could imagine left and right. Well, actually, it was already relevant in the previous talk. So a quantum bundle for me is not simply a Hopf-Galois extension. I think that is a great bit of misdirection in terminology, because that only corresponds to a universal differential calculus, and the true geometry lies in the non-universal calculi that you've chosen. What you really want is that you have an algebra and you have a quantum group acting on it, or co-acting on it by a coaction. M should be the fixed point, as in Gianni's talk. What you want is that the horizontal one-forms, the one-forms pulled back from the base, should be exactly the things that are killed by this canonical map, which is this map here, is the generator of the vertical vector fields. You see, if you had what is lambda 1 here? Lambda 1 is the space of left invariant one-forms on the fiber group. So omega 1 is the differential forms on the group. For any Hopf algebra that's left covariant, then it's actually a free module, and lambda and generated by left invariant one forms. So this is like the dual of the Lie algebra. So if you imagine this is a bit like a coaction, if you were to evaluate with a Lie algebra element, then you would have a map from omega 1 to p, which is to say you would have a vector field. So that would be the vector field associated to the Lie algebra element. So this is the generator of the vertical vector fields, and that should exactly kill the horizontal one forms. If you take the universal calculi, you will just have the definition of a Hopf-Galois extension. Now, why do you care about this? Well, this one, a connection on this is a splitting of this. And in classical geometry, if you look in Kobayashi, for example, that corresponds to a connection one form, and the one form should be a Lie algebra value function or a map from lambda 1, which is the dual of the Lie algebra, into omega 1 p. But it should be ad covariant and based on other properties. Now, in order to have ad covariance, that's where you need. That's exactly where you need that the calculus on the quantum group is bicovariant. Okay. So I'm just giving you some of the ingredients that go into model building and why you need them. And as we've seen, you can make some very interesting models.
Is there a notion of not bicovariant but just ad covariant calculus?
Well, you want it to be left covariant anyway, otherwise you haven't even got a free module.
So then if it is ad covariant, it's bicovariant.
All of what I've said can actually be generalized if you really try to some extent, but not fully. Okay. Now, the model, just to put you, this is for really for physicists now, to just to think about looking at a model, and it is only a toy model, although one that had been taken quite seriously in the literature. The algebra, as I said, functions that commute, but time doesn't commute. According to what I'm saying, everything should follow just from the algebra and mathematics. So nothing should depend on these particular choice of generators, right? Mathematics is coordinate invariant, general relativity is coordinate invariant, and therefore when you do anything in non-linear geometry, it shouldn't be dependent on your choice of coordinates if you're doing it abstractly or properly. So we just have this algebra, and we ask ourselves, what are the possible things that obey the axioms I asked for differential forms? And that's a matter of classifying certain ideals, and that was actually done by Robert Uckel, who was my student at the time. You can come up with this calculus anyway, but there are reasons. But this is anyway from the classification or partial classification. This is the only reasonable choice. So omega 1 is a free module, and these generators dxi obey these commutations. Well, they commute, but these don't commute. So the calculus is non-commutative.
Are you assuming some compatibility with a natural grading or something like that?
No, I'm not using the grading, but I'm using that it's translation invariant. This is a Hopf algebra, because actually the enveloping algebra of a Lie algebra. And so that means it has a co-product delta, and delta x mu is x mu tensor 1 plus 1 tensor x mu. And what that tells you is that this is not just an algebra, but it has the translation law for addition on Rn. So this is a non-commutative version of R4, but it retains the translation law for R4 as a Hopf algebra structure. And now, so what this is we're classifying is a translation invariant differential calculi. Okay. Once you have found the calculus, the invariantly defined object is D, the exterior derivative. However, you can expand it in the basis. So that then defines, that's the definition of the partial derivatives. These are not constructed by hand. These are calculated from the definition. So when you do the calculation, you find that di is the normal ordered version of the ordinary derivative. Now, what normal order means, I'm put all the x's to the left. So if you put all x's to the left and differentiate, you will get the value on this possibly non-commutative function. And similarly, d0, but this comes out not as a usual normal order differential, but as a finite difference in imaginary time. And none of that is put in. I is put in for unitarity reasons, but all of that then follows from the calculation, from the algebra. Now, the next thing that you do, if you want to do things, is you diagonalize. We're just following classical mathematics, if you like. So once you've got the partial derivatives, we find the plane waves, which by diagonalizing those. And so they're diagonalized exactly by something you might have guessed, which is these. They're labeled by P and P0, x's to the left. And then these are their eigenvalues. Now, there's a little bit of fudging with this factor here, which is not essential. You can even forget about it. But here the exterior algebra is an obvious one because you just take the wedge product, the usual anti-commutative wedge product, commutative product, and there's an obvious Hausdorff operator. So you just identify these with the classical R4. And so that gives you the obvious wave operator, which is d0 squared minus di squared. But these are the non-commutative partial derivatives up here, these operators. Now on the plane waves, they look like that. So that tells us our dispersion relation. And
we don't go too fast, Charles. I suppose the rationale for taking the wedge is the fact that the co-product is co-commutative or something like that.
Yeah. So what I said was in the previous slide was that sometimes there is a canonical. And so another advantage of a bicovariant calculus, yes, which this one is that there is then a canonical wedge product procedure, which is compatible with Poincaré duality. It's the best quotient you could want. This is the Voronovich construction. Okay. And so that's what we use here. And so now, all of that was canonical, and now we have to make an assumption. We have to say how are we going to see a non-commutative plane wave? Okay, so there are that's really a question for physicists. But a cheap way to do it is suppose that you have some kind of classicalization map, which takes you from your non-commutative algebra into classical functions of x and t. And so in this particular example, it's an obvious one that you just identify a normal ordered function with the corresponding classical function. And so, in other words, you're saying that if you always measure x before t, then you will observe the non-commutative function as if it was a classical function. I mean, that's the answer that Amelino, Camilia, and I made when we did this analysis.
But how do you choose a t in the universe? I mean, you take like the background radiation or something like that?
This is part of the the physical interpretation, which I don't know the answer to, but part of the question which we'll come to is what is Poincaré invariance? So I mean, that's a deep question, which I can try to comment on.
Experiments, you have to single out which variable.
Yeah. So you are breaking Lorentz invariance at this point in some sense by choosing the classicalization map, and we are going to be working in a particular frame, if you like, but there will be a quantum group behind which will rotate frames. Anyway, the speed of light then, if you suppose that, then you can think, assuming that spin one fields propagate the same way as scalar fields, which is more or less obvious, then the speed of light will come from this assumption. You can then compute how the wavefronts look by looking at them classically, and then you'll see that the speed of light is the usual formula. This formula cannot be assumed unless you've justified it, and that was a justification. Then you will get this. So you see the speed of light varies with energy. And this kind of formula was speculated by people working with this algebra, but there wasn't an analysis until we went through it with Amelino Camilia. Now, this could be tested by the GLASS satellite next year or the year after, which looks at gamma ray bursts. So they have a spread of energies, and they travel cosmological distances. So when they arrive on Earth, they'll have a spread of arrival times. And when you put the numbers in, that's 10 to the minus 44 seconds, an incredibly small number. But you also have a very large number, which is the light year length of the universe. So you'll get something of an order of a millisecond. Now if you could actually create a source with two different energies at some instant in time, other side of the universe, you would have the experiment. But what you actually have is you don't actually know. So you don't actually know the spread. the gamma ray burst, but on the other hand, this effect is quite over distance. So if you look for a statistical correlation of the gamma ray bursts with distance, they're finding that they're slightly more spread out as they're further away, then you could find this effect. And so by a large number of analysis of the gamma ray burst detected by GLAST, this may be possible, and it's part of the mission protocol. Now, what about Poincaré invariance? Poincaré, there is a quantum group here, which is actually of a bicross product form. And so you see that, okay, I don't say much about it. The only modified generator from the usual Poincaré, these are the boosts, these are the momenta. All the other relations, these are the angular, these are the rotations. If you know your usual Poincaré group, I've used the standard names for the generators. All the registers are the same one except for these two. These are the only modified ones for the algebra and for the co-product here. And this bicross product comes from the factorization of SO41 in this way. And what's happening here is that when a group factorizes, then you can take things in the wrong order. If you take things in the wrong order and then refactorize, then apply the factorization, then you will see that there's an action of each group on the other. This is called a matched pair of groups. And these are nonlinear actions. And in particular, the action of the Lorentz generator on the momentum generator is this nonlinear vector field. Think of it. Is this? So that nonlinear, and there's also a back reaction the other way. And I would just say that this was the earlier version. If you put 3 here instead of 4, that was what was in my thesis in 87. These were one of the first quantum groups.
You just asked a physical question. Your lambda, you picked to be 10^-44. Was that for some?
That was just something which, if the effect was a quantum gravity effect, then you would expect it to be Planck scale because it has dimensions of time, right? If there's reason to think it's much larger than that, that'd be wonderful. It'd be easier to detect. Okay. Now, that nonlinear action means that actually the Lorentz group, okay, so back up, the Lorentz group here is acting, it's actually undeformed. The Lorentz group itself is undeformed, but it's acting on R3-1 in a nonlinear way. And also R3-1 is deformed, namely it's a non-abelian group. So those are the two deformations, and it acts back. Those are the three deformations in the picture. So the first deformation, which is the nonlinear action of the deformed action of the Lorentz group, means that the mass shells are deformed. So this is the usual mass shells are like cones, but what's happening is they're all getting compressed. The upper mass shell, which is the physical sector, is getting compressed into a cylinder of radius 1 over lambda, And so that means that if you were to be down here and you were to boost the particle and keep on boosting, you would still have a finite spatial momentum. So this is a Planckian bound. But there are many other effects, that's in the literature, but there are many other effects which haven't yet made it to the literature, to the physics literature. And one of them is that, well, the other action, because you see the point is that this factorization is only a local factorization. It blows up. It has singularities.
And this gives that kind of bound on momenta?
Yes, that was the Planck.
Kind of cut off on momenta.
At the Planck scale, yes. Exactly. But there are other effects. For example, if you have momentum down here, there is a back reaction of, there will be a Lorentz transformation. If you look in the R physical sector, there will be Lorentz transformations that will boost you off to infinity. Which is okay, but there are a number of effects, but I guess the one I want to mention is really in the dual. So let me just think how to say that. So the point is that this construction here, if you look at the co-algebra, it's also this is a semi-direct product as an algebra. If you look at the dual, it's also a semi-direct product, and so that means that the coordinate ring of the Poincaré group is also a semi-direct product. Now, if you look in the coordinate algebra, when the back reaction blows up, the commutation relations between the lambda mu nu coordinates. So if you want to actually make a frame rotation, you'll have coordinates for rotations, and you'll have some coordinates. I better call them a mu for the translations. This is in the coordinate algebra of the quantum Poincaré group, but there'll be commutation relations given by the back reaction, and they will actually blow up. They can be singular for some values of momenta and what that means is that the uncertainty, if you try to measure your frame rotation, if you try to do a frame rotation, the uncertainty in the frame rotation and in the translation, you won't be able to measure them both simultaneously, and that uncertainty can get worse and worse. So there's some very interesting physical phenomena which have not at all been studied. There's another problem from the mathematical side, and this is the anomaly which I'm talking about today. lambda that model is very nice, but lambda 1 is not actually Poincaré covariant. It was translation covariant, but it's not covariant under the Poincaré group. And for that, you need you appear to need a 5D calculus, which was suggested by Sitosh. And so there's an extra dimension that will come in from somewhere, and it won't be time, because we've already got time. It'll be something. Okay. Now I'm going to start on the next... I'm going rather too slowly. So here's a theorem. So let's switch to mathematics now and tell you some theorems about this anomaly. So the first theorem... So this section will all be joint, and the next section on quasi-associative geometry will be joint work with Edwin Beggs. For a simple group G or Lie algebra, there does not exist omega 1 of classical dimension. So all quantum groups, if you want a bicovariant calculus, and a U of G, which is the quantization of G star. I mean, even before quantum groups, there were interesting quantizations, and they were the enveloping algebras of Lie algebras, viewed as a quantization of G star, equipped with this Kirilov-Kostant bracket. That's some bracket. That was studied by many mathematicians. So both of these famous examples, at least in mathematics, do not admit reasonable... differential calculi which have the right dimensions and reasonable symmetries. Okay, so now, by the way, an anomaly in physics is usually viewed as you do something with the current algebra and the symmetry is lost when you quantize. But I've turned it around. I'm saying if you want to keep the symmetry, then the calculus is lost. But it's essentially the same kind of obstruction. It's just being viewed in different ways. So I'm going to give you two proofs because they have different domains of applicability. The algebraic proof actually goes down to classification of differential calculi and quantum groups, which first appeared in my work and later on some students of Rosso. So lambda 1 here are classified by Voronovich as quotient objects of objects of the augmentation ideal of A plus. So A is the quantum group in question, one of these two. Plus means, if you like, it's the functions that vanish at the origin if it was a classical group. And cross modules, or Drinfeld-Yetter modules, are just the modules of Drinfeld quantum double, or co-modules of the co-double. Now, there's a theorem that when you have a quasi-triangular structure or universal R matrix, then the co-double is actually related to, and in the factorizable case isomorphic to, two copies of the original quantum group with a double cross-product structure, which is the factorization of Hopf algebras. And so that means that this category, where this A plus lives, is equivalent, is actually this category here of co-modules of this guy. But now, this is a twist, and when you do Drinfeld twists, you actually don't change the category up to equivalence. So this category, which is a complicated one, is actually equivalent to a much simpler one, which is just by co-modules. And so in particular, A plus is just one particular object in there, and the particular action, particular co-module structure that's relevant, becomes here just the left and right co-actions. So what you have is just the Peter-Weyl decomposition of A plus will tell you that the irreducible pieces, the irreducible differential calculi, meaning ones with no proper quotients, are just of this form given by Irabs of the quantum group. So this is the space of one form. In particular, they have square dimensions. They have dimensions n squared for n an integer. And this applies in the form power series setting. If you want to do it for in finite dimensional case, you can use the same theorem. These Hopf algebras that reduce quantum groups at roots of unity are also finite dimensional, factorizable, co-quasi-triangular Hopf algebras. This time you use the block decomposition of the enveloping algebra. So for example, at cube root of unity, the block decomposition of UQSU2 has two pieces. And this piece here, if you divide by the Jacobson radical, which is the intersection of all the two-sided ideals, so the semi-simple part in some sense, then you have C plus M2. And I only mention this because C plus M2 plus M3 was in Alan's talk on Monday. Now this block decomposition actually tells you that here we're using it to classify the calculi. So there'll be, but again, you won't have ones of classical dimension. Okay. The second proof is differential geometric. So what we do, we assume that A is a deformation. So that means that the product is actually the lowest order given by a Poisson bracket. That should be squared there, or the lambda squared. Now, suppose the same thing is true for the differential calculus. So the differential calculus deforms this one to lowest order in lambda. Deforms the classical one. Because it's deforming it, the functions might not commute with one form. Then we can define the commutator to be this object here, which we can call, it's just some kind of connection. And uh, I, I, we call it a partial connection or pre-connection. What you can think of it actually depends on a function A, but you should think of it as a connection in the direction A hat, where A hat is the Hamiltonian vector field corresponding to A.
I missed the punchline of the proof number one.
Okay, basically all the dimensions here are too big because they're all squared. So for example, for SU2, the small dimension, one dimension is 4.
Oh, okay, fine. Okay.
Sorry, I should have said that. They're much too big, not just a little bit too big, they're much too big. So now in this other proof we use deformation theory. Now, so that object, we call it a pre-connection, but it can be written more formally as the Liandro-Broglie contravariant connection, which was pointed out by Hawkins, I was from dinner last night, Eli Hawkins. I wrote this after dinner, okay, so... he was supposed that you had an exact differential calculus, not up to lowest order. He was interested in something different, but he sort of identified the obstruction in some sense. But we are going further. We're just supposing that we're making minimal assumptions here. So we just have this connection, which may or may not have curvature. So he was basically only limited to the zero curvature case. In our case, we're not limited like that. We've got some kind of connection, and the properties you can deduce are it is a connection. That's what that says. This other identity, it would make sense if you thought of that as the way you should think of it as a connection. Now, if that's that, and if this was a connection, that would be tensorial. You could take the A outside, so you should have that. So the green bit is not defined, but the left and right of that equation are what are equal. And the third is a compatibility condition. So we call this a Poisson compatible pre-connection. And here's the most important lemma: is if you look at the Jacobiator, whether or not omega 1 is a bimodule. If omega 1 really was a bimodule, then the Jacobiator would be associative. That's what bimodule means. So the Jacobiator would vanish. And so here the Jacobiator turned out to be exactly the curvature of this pre-connection. So, and in the symplectic case, things are nicer. You could even say that in the nice case, it's actually an honest connection in the symplectic case, and this connection is an honest symplectic connection and torsion-free. So, and that's the same data as used by Fedosov in Fedosov quantization. So, in fact, quantizing a Poisson bracket is not a well-posed problem. You've got to choose more data. But if you try to quantize a Poisson bracket and a symplectic torsion-free connection, then Fedosov gives you at least one random construction for one. So, in some sense, it could be that what's really canonical is quantization of a manifold equipped with the leading order part of its differential structure. So, the problem of quantizing an algebra of quantization, problem of non-commutative geometry is more well posed than the problem of an algebra itself, if you like. Okay. Now, in the Poisson-Lie group case, a Poisson-Lie group means that the product map here is a Poisson map. Of course, for any Lie group, you should immediately trivialize the tangent bundle or cotangent bundle. So a one form here can be viewed equivalently as a function with values on G star. Okay. That's known to every geometer. So in those terms. I call it Nabla-tilde when you're doing it on this side. So Nabla-tilde of some function with values... Oh, another typo. This is functions on G with values in G star. They're given by the Poisson bracket plus something of this form, where C is some tensor like that, and the requirement is that. So that's a classification of the differential of this data in the left covariant case. If it's quasi-triangular, so that means it comes from an R matrix, the classical solution of the classical Young-Baxter equation, which is true for the quantum groups of interest, then the condition on C is equivalent to this guy being symmetric. And Nabla-tilde the thing is bicovariant if this C hat is ad invariant. Now, by the time you've got something that's if the algebra is simple and you want something that's symmetric and ad invariant, then we know from invariant theory that we haven't got any. So C hat has to be zero. Well, at least when G is, unless G is SLN n bigger than 2, when it could be, you have something which is the cubic Casimir. So the proof of that is basically Constant's theorem that the symmetric algebra on G decomposes, symmetric polynomials decompose into invariant ones and harmonic ones, or into the tensor product of those. The invariant ones have degrees MI plus 1. The harmonic one itself decomposes under ADD, which is what's relevant here, decomposition under ADD, into the rank of the G copies of the group copies of G of different degrees MI. But now when you look in the tables for these exponents MI, you find that there aren't any when MI equals 2. So there's nothing in degree 2 to map into. If you view this C as a map, C has a map from, view it the other way, as a map from G into the symmetric algebra of S2, there's nothing for it to map into. Okay. So what we found is that there is a canonical connection, which is C hat equals zero, and it's the only one for SLN, except for SLN bigger than two. So there's a unique data at the semi-classical level, and that gives you this essentially unique data, and this gives you this particular connection. This is a very simple inference formula, but now we have an action of the two pieces of R on functions and one-forms. And the curvature is the action of this Cartan tensor. This is a canonical element of wedge 3G, which is ad invariant. It's built from the split Casimir, from the killing form. So in the other case, we left it to the reader, but it's clear that you could have something from the split Casimir, but that curvature will never cancel this part of the curvature. So the curvature will always be non-zero. So that proves the result for all CQG. So if it can't happen at the semi-classical level, you couldn't have the quantum version either, right? Okay. I will just briefly say that what happens in the other case. For UG, so U lambda is not a quantum group, it's just the envelope, well, it is a quantum group, but it's just the enveloping algebra, the usual enveloping algebra of the Lie algebra. But I've just put the parameter lambda in here to remind you that it's a deformation. As lambda goes to zero, it just becomes a commutative algebra. So translation covariance, as we saw in our example, but this time translation covariance in the setting gives us a unique semi-classical data. It has to be of this form. And again, C hat will have to be zero using invariant theory. And so that gives you this curvature, which again is not zero. Except for G SLN and bigger than two, then we redo the calculation in the paper. We show that it's never not zero even in that case. Okay. So that's the no-go theorem. So basically, at this point, what we've got is for most quantum groups, most of those examples of interest in a wide range of examples, we won't be able to find an associative differential calculus because of the failure of the Jacobiator, even at the semi-classical level. So the next section is we embrace co-associative geometry, non-associative, quasi-associative geometry. So the background for this is actually, again, some work of Drinfeld, who really has had a huge influence on the whole theory from the quantum group side. Now, he constructed the quantum group CQG effectively. He didn't do it this way, but effectively did it as follows. Start with the classical group, take a certain co-chain. So basically, it just means any function from here, which is invertible in a certain sense, from H10 to H into four power series in the parameter. And then by conjugating the product by it, so here, all right, the ones and the twos are simply the co-product. The co-product of any element A in the Hopf algebra is an element of H tensor H. I'm writing the one for the piece that lives in the left copy of H and two for the piece that lives in the second copy. If I apply it several times, then I'll have many copies, and then the one, two, three, you know which copy it lives in. So if you conjugate the product in that sense, the old product, initial product, the classical product, by this F, you will get a certain non-commutative product. And that will actually, in Drinfeld's theorem, is that if you choose F correctly by solving the commutative examinological equations, then this is actually giving you the Hopf algebra isomorphic to the quantum group CQG. Now, this is in principle a co-quasi-Hopf algebra, because if you just take that formula and work out the associator, you'll see that actually it's not associative. In principle, you have to conjugate by phi phi inverse, where phi is this given this expression here. I've left that, so I've stopped writing the ones and the twos. This is some kind of Hopf 3 cocycle. But it's non-abelian. These are all, okay, but anyway. But Drinfeld's associator happens, phi happens to be central, so it just cancels out, which is lucky because this is an ordinary Hopf algebra. But it's really an accident. Now, if you apply this twisting theory, you can apply this twisting theory to solve our quantization problem for differential calculus. The classical calculus on a group is actually a super Hopf algebra. That's actually why Hopf invented Hopf algebras. The co-product on degree one is just the left and the right coactions that I began my talk with. At the classical level. But now we can view F as a co-chain, not on H, but on this, just as easily, just by extending it by zero. And then we define the differential calculus on the quantum group, which means on this twisted HF, as the twisting of the classical theory algebra. So I'm basically defining the differential calculus on the twisted one as the twisting of the classical differential calculus. That will be some super co-quasi-Hopf algebra. It will quantize C hat equals zero, but this time phi will not commute through because the action is not on the formula are very similar to these, but in here, but A, B could be a one form, or C could be a one form. And now functions, now you can't just cancel phi. The action on one form is different from the action on functions. And so you will get something which truly quantize, which is quasi associative, as it must be by our no-go theorem. Okay. So now for the other example is a bit more involved. We have to use one of the categories, which is a nice thing for you to use anyway, in my opinion. So you just have a collection of objects, you've got some tensor product, you've got some re-bracketing isomorphisms phi between two orders of tensor products, and it's in the background here, we don't actually use it today. You will typically also have a braiding, which is for a change of order of the tensor product. And a quasi-algebra just means an algebra in this category. But an algebra in the category means that this diagram commutes, except that you must use the rebracketing wherever you need. That's Maclean's theorem. So Maclean's theorem says that working in one of these categories is as good as working in an ordinary category, where everything is associative, except that when you can even pretend it's associative. But whenever you actually want to work anything out, you should stick in phi appropriately to make the brackets work. So it's as good as associative. You haven't thrown away very much. But it won't actually be associative from the point of view of all, if you didn't think you were in the category. Now, if you have an algebra in the in this category of co-modules, the original Hopf algebra, then after twisting, this will be some quasi-Hopf algebra. Category will be have a non-trivial associator, but because this is equivalent to categories, any diagram over here will commute also over here. Just apply this functor, so this twisting functor or quantization functor will just immediately quantize anything. An algebra, differential calculus, a Dirac operator, whatever you want. And you just pass it over. In the case of an algebra, it will anything that's covariant, that is, it will modify the product in this way. Okay. So in particular, the example of interest is when G acts on a manifold M classically. That means to say we're working in a dual way with coordinate algebra on M. It is a co-module algebra for the coordinate algebra of G. Now we apply any cochain, like of the example we had before. You apply the twisting. If you take Grimfeld's one, this will become the quantum group CQG. But this upper F construction is the twisting of the algebra. This will become some twisted algebra, and also its differential calculus will become some twisted differential calculus. And just to make it clear here, this is not necessarily going to be associative. So if you take the Jacobiate to the lowest order, you will discover that the Poisson bracket defined by the commutator actually obeys something plus equals something non-zero here. So that's called a quasi-Poisson manifold. And that's of interest in string theory, such objects. Now, we're going to apply this in the case of Z simple. Z is what we previously called G, but we'll take Z be a simple Lie algebra. We'll take G to be its double, so that has this form. M to be the space Z star. We're going to quantize it. The appropriate cocycle was found by, in general, for any Lie bi-algebra, we're using a special case of that, was found by Ettinghoff and Kajdan. And in their special case, it's more or less clear that, you'll get something when you apply this cocycle, this cochain. So the G, which is the classical double now, of Z, will quantize to something, and this will be the co-double. Okay. Meanwhile, the algebra on which it acts, so that's H goes to HF. The classical group will go to the co-double of Z, the quantum double of Z. The CM of F will go to so the classical manifold will go to the twisted one, and this will be the enveloping algebra of Z. So that will achieve the quantization we talked about before, but now apply the same construction to omega. So you just do the same construction, not for the algebra, but for the differential calculus. Pass it over in the category, you will get the twisted differential calculus, and you will find that you have exactly quantized the C hat equals zero connection on UZ. So both of the two obstructions that I mentioned before, they can be overcome, and they are quantized, but as quasi-algebras. Okay, I think I've got time for this. All this theory applies, was aimed at quantization, which usually means you have some smooth manifold or something in the background. But since it's all algebraic, you can do it over any field, and you can even do it for finite cases. So you can just do it for H. This is the classical object, the classical group, symmetry group. It's just going to be Z2 cross Z2 cross Z2. So I'm going to think of that as just polynomials in UV and W with those relations, and a basis like that. And there's a certain cocycle. This fits into the previous slide. There's a certain cochain, and it's given by this formula. And this was found in 1998 by Helena Albuquerque and myself. But after many years, I found a very nice characterization of this. I mean, I'm not sure it's a unique characterization, but it has a very nice property, which is this f, which is very, otherwise is a bit like a Chern-Simon theorem. It's got quadratic part plus cubic part. But anyway, it's a bit mysterious. But actually, it has a very nice property that if you Z2 Fourier transform this function on the group, it's a function in two variables on Z2 to the 3. If you transform each variable on at the same time, on Z2 in Z2 3 switch on, you get the same thing, except you don't get the same thing. You get the same thing up to with a cyclic permutation of U, V, and W. So it's a bit like a Gaussian, except that it's also with a cyclic permutation, which is a very strange object. But it's a nice characterization of it. And now if you compute the co-cycle, then you get the free co-cycle, which is the associator. Then you get exactly a very nice thing, minus 1 to the determinant of these three Z2-valued vectors. These are A, B, and C are Z2-valued vectors that describe a general element.
I don't get what is phi. What is phi?
This is the co-boundary of F. So this is measure the non-associativity of the algebra.
Oh, okay.
So and what you get here for the twisted algebra is exactly AF. So basically, it's exactly Altonians. So the Altonians are exactly a quantization of Z2 cross Z2 cross Z2. That's what they are in this co-cycle sense.
They are associative up to the.
They are associative in the appropriate category, which is the category of this as a quasi-Hopf algebra, H, and which is unchanged, and phi as a quasi-Hopf algebra. So what that means is they're associative up to phi, exactly. And also because of McLane's theorem, it means that they are as good as associative. You can forget all that alternative theory. They are exactly as strong as being associative. Now, the other thing is that the differential calculus, well, let's again start with the classical calculus on Z2 to the 3. So that's, well, Z2 has a unique calculus, which is a universal one. So you just take three copies of that, and that just looks like this. For experts in non-Hodge geometry, will know that one. But Tori are the generators of the left invariant one forms, and they are exactly the generators of the cohomology, just as they are for S1 cross S1 cross S1. So you should think of Z2 to the 3 with this calculus as a discrete version of S1 cross S1 cross S1. And now we quantize that, applying the twisting functor. So now we get the differential calculus on the Octonians. And that's the answer. The only thing I want to say is that whereas this one was a bit complicated, you had sometimes minus signs, sometimes plus signs, here functions always anticommute with one forms, at least on the generators. They all have a minus sign. Whereas on the other hand, all the one forms always commute with each other. So things have been reversed, but also made more symmetric. So I mean, that's cute. And you can go on and you can do physics, you can do gauge theory if you want. I have a paper on that. Okay. So now, in the remaining 10 minutes, the thing you've all been waiting for. So that was approach A. Was okay. You embrace the non-associativity. You live in a non-associative world, and I think that shouldn't be dismissed, though it's a
message. It's quasi-associative.
Quasi-associative.
Yeah.
Yes.
Much better.
Yes.
Than
yes.
Non-associative.
Yes. I agree. Non-associativity has a bad name. Yes.
Quasi-associative is much better.
Okay. So the deeper non-commutative geometry of quantum groups and other examples, which are not my, in this setting, what happens in the Moyard spaces, etc., is that F is actually a not in this example, but in the general theory, F is actually a co-cycle, not a co-chain. So that means the co-boundary vanishes. That means phi vanishes, and so this twisting functor still works, and everything just works smoothly, but there's no anomaly. Okay, So the alternative is to somehow. And the other thing I should say about anomalies is that anomalies in physics are measured by curvature. And we've seen that in our talk. This anomaly is measured by the curvature of a certain symplectic or Poisson-compatible preconnection. So these are very, very similar to physical anomalies, but this is not physics, at least not physics as we know it. But it's very analogous. Now, the other thing is that let's just show you what I mean by two examples, and then we will judge whether it's a general phenomenon or not. Okay. So sometimes it's possible to neutralize the anomaly by extra dimensions. So here's an example. This I mentioned that these algebras. Well, this is essentially what was in Roger's talk, the underlying non-Hilbert space. So again, starting with the algebra and nothing else, you classify all the differential calculi that are by the translation invariant, and this was done by myself and Batista, and you come up with there's only one reasonable choice. And this is four dimensions. So the calculus is generated by functions, which means it's the elements of the non-commutative algebra, and a basis dxi and one extra generator, theta, which has no classical analog. Now you compute theta. The commutation relations are here. and you see that if you left out the red term, you would have exactly the C hat equals zero pre-connection in the previous talk. That was a non-associative one. So if you left that out, you wouldn't have Bayesian identity, and you'd have exactly the non-associative one. But if by adding such a term, you can verify that you will have a Jacobi identity, but provided also you have that. And now, once you have the calculus, which is determined invariantly from the geometry, from the algebra, from the classification of bimodules, you will then have the theory derivative and expand it in this way, as before. You have these in the classical limit will become the usual differentials, usual partial derivatives. What they look like at the quantum level is quite complicated, but I do have formulae for them. But d0 is interesting. This is a new object. And when you compute it, it actually can be written in terms of the other objects. I mean, it's an operator from this algebra to itself, a certain operator, so it turns out to be looked like that. Now, as lambda goes to zero, in the asymptotic, d0 over lambda has a limit, or if you like, d0 looks like that in the limit. So actually, I've just derived Schrodinger's equation. So I'm saying that there's an extra direction, and the things with respect to this extra direction automatically obey Schrodinger's equation for a particle of mass m is 1 over lambda. Now, the mass is completely variable. The point is the depth normalization of theta. So I can have the extra direction has a conjugate associated to it, and that conjugate is the mass, which is, so the normalization of one will change the other. So if this theory has a prediction that it's saying there's a particle, and this extra dimension has associated to it some mass, but this mass is not predicted, it just has to be non-zero. Okay. Here, for this choice of normalization, it's just the Planck mass, which is somehow the most natural. The suggested... now, if you want to go a bit further and actually want to actually add join t such that theta is dc, theta is not d of anything because it's just an extra direction in the cotangent bundle. But if you wanted to be d of something, you can add join time. So we add join time as a central variable. And then, again, you go back to the differential calculus and you find that theta, the t and dt or theta have to again not commute, and that forces you to the finite difference differential structure again calculus. So this extra variable that you can adjoin can be done, but this will actually have a finite difference differential structure. If you classify all the differential structures on polynomials in one variable, they will always be of this type for some finite difference, which could be zero, which was Newton's discovery, or it could be not zero, the displacement. Okay. Now next thing you do is you find the plane waves, and these are just the group elements viewed as they are just viewed in terms of these generators, which are like our RP generators. So they just don't, the x's don't commute. But there are these plane waves, and these plane waves diagonalize the partial derivatives above, and they also solve the Schrödinger equation, the one with t now, provided mod p is less than this. Now this is in a coordinate system for SU2. I mean, what's happening is that the dual space momentum is an element of SU2, but that coordinate system is perfectly valid. It's valid all the way up to pi over lambda, not pi over 2 lambda. So this is a genuine sort of cutoff, sort of Planckian cutoff, which is before the coordinate system breaks down, and again you have a modified dispersion relation. So you have the same kind of phenomena here as we had before. Now, the other example, I just want to say that there is one more thing I can say about this model, is that if you're only interested in the three-dimensional case, then there is a Euclidean group of motions, which is now a quantum group, which is the quantum double, that was also seen from the Ettinger, Kajal and co-cycle construction. So there is a quantum double in the background where this algebra lives, which is deformation of SO3 acting on R3. But this, when you adjoin T, then you would like to have a four-dimensional quantum group but I haven't found one. So this seems to be a highly non-relativistic thing at this point. So this induced time is somehow, in this example, not the previous one, but in this example, has somehow really broken Lorentz invariance if it really was going to apply to physics, it would have to be stored somewhere. But it also suggests that this could be a lot of fun and useful for something, but it may not be quantum gravity. Okay, if you're fixated on having a, if you're really trying to apply it to space-time. Okay, the other example is just again mathematics, just to show you it's not a unique phenomenon. Do the same thing with quantum SU2. So there again, the smallest calculus is four-dimensional. We've seen that from my proof one of the first theorem. because the small juxtaposition is the two-dimensional one, so that means it's quantum NV is four-dimensional. And so it has four generators, E plus, T zero, E minus, T zero, and theta. Now, these are the ones which become in the classical limit, the left invariant, the standard left invariant one forms. The theta is a new object. The commutation relations are now much more complicated. They're again forced by the classification, but you can compute them. I've just written the simplest one, but there are many others which involve Q commutators and things. But the element theta has very nice commutation relations. Psi with theta is lambda d theta, d psi. So I can define my abstractly defined object d psi, expand it in the basis like I did before. Now I compute d zero. It's a very long calculation, but eventually, and you have to do it in two sectors, in two coordinate patches. One coordinate patch is to look at monomials like that. The other one with monomials where you have an A here instead of a D. But in those two coordinate patches, which therefore means everywhere, this C0 operator has eigenvalues, has a form, which in the classical limit is exactly the Laplace-Beltrami operator. So you could take that as a definition if you want of the Q-deform Laplace-Beltrami operator. But anyway, in the classical limit, you again recover Schrödinger's equation, but now on the curve manifold SU2. So the previous example wasn't just a sort of fake one. It's really a fairly general phenomenon. Okay. Now, many. So I'm coming up toward the end of my talk, but the many. This is quite a general phenomenon. I mean, it doesn't always show up. It doesn't show up for the torus, etc. No, I didn't take that back. Many, in fact, almost all geometries of interest are actually inner, in the sense that there is a one-form theta. Even in our very first example of the bicross product model or Kappa spacetime model, the DT did have that theta. There was a theta which was just DT. So there, we didn't need to adjoin time because it was already there, and indeed, it wasn't thrown up because it was already there. But if it wasn't there, it would actually be thrown up, because it's a very common phenomenon that you would expect to have for any sufficiently non-commutative differential calculus. D is some kind of automorphism in some sense of the exterior algebra, so it would typically be inner. So there would typically be this element, theta, such that this is there, such that this equation holds. But this equation has no classical meaning. You would never see it in classical geometry because this side goes to zero when lambda goes to zero, and this side goes to zero because functions commute one forms classically. So this equation is completely invisible in the classical world. It's a purely quantum phenomenon, but yet it's true. It's expected to be there in great generality. So when you start with a classical system, you've got some. If you're trying to do the things the wrong way, to go from classical geometry to non-commutative geometry, you might be able to quantize them, find the corresponding quantum versions. But there's nothing in the classical world which would become theta. So that's why you often have to adjoin theta. Theta is something which is purely quantum. It might be that it is there, and then in the first example it was there as dt, so you didn't have to adjoin it. But if it wasn't there, what I'm saying is that if time wasn't already there, it would have to be generated by the non-commutative geometry, because it might already be there. But you would expect some variable playing this role. Now, whatever this one form, if it's part of the basis, And I should say that omega 1 is not necessarily even a free module. So it's talking about a basis is not necessarily something you can always do. But if you have in some localization of the algebra, if you have a basis, then the conjugate in the exterior derivative to theta will always be some operator, and it will typically have a classical limit. So this will be the induced limit. This will be the induced Hamiltonian in classical geometry, induced from the quantum geometry. And so here's a philosophical point. You know, is this why things evolve? I mean, forget about details, is it relativistic, not relativistic, etc. I mean, in physics we start with what we observe classically and we're always trying to quantize it or whatever. But we should ask a more basic question: why are there equations of motion? And this could be why that not sufficiently non-commutative algebras will have this inner element, and this will have a remnant in the classical world, and then it will appear in the way I've shown. Now it's tied up with this anomaly. And the other question is really a question for Alain: is it related to the modular group? So this, you know, obviously I knew about Alain Ravelli's proposal for generation of time, but But this is just something that has been known even earlier than that paper by people who work in nonlinear geometry, that you have this obstruction. And so I was thinking about how to tie them up, but I don't really understand, because this doesn't have any of the machinery that's required for the modular group. So this would work over other fields and in finite cases. Now the last topic, just 1 minute, is really a paper I've written recently with Laurent Pridal at the Perimeter when I was there for 6 months. In this particular model, USU2, which is the spin network space-time, actually does arise. So if you go back to the very first transparent, the very first slide, I was saying nonlinear geometry should arise as an effective theory of quantum gravity. So that was, so in a paper with Batista, based, inspired by works of Schroer and others, that we suggested that this should be the appropriate space-time coming out of 2 plus 1 quantum gravity. And that was then shown recently by, a year ago, by Friedel and Levine. And in particular, they have an effective action which takes this form for the theory. Now, these are classical fields on R3, and this is a bullet product, a deformed product. And these are classical derivatives. And this is a piece of, they can also consider interaction terms, etc. But this is a deformation theoretic setting, but it's not the Mayol product here. It's given by another product, and that product is defined through plane waves. Basically, you say that the plane waves, the classical plane waves, deform to their quantum ones, if you like. But there's a problem there. You can only do it for half integer spin. And if you look carefully at that paper, they do something very non-canonical. They take one system for SO2, but they only use the upper half of it. And they identify the other upper half with SO3, and they use that as an explanation why they only work with integer spin. But that's not the right thing to do. SO3 should be a quotient space of SU2. So there are some, and so if you try to do what they've done, you've got some discontinuity. So if you want to do it properly for SU2, you've got to, which is what we looked at, you've got to get into that, into those plane waves in the full coordinate system. So here, these are the plane waves. They work for, we're thinking of this as a representation of SU2. Think of that as a group element. Then you get every point in SU2 except for the south pole in this range of the coordinate system. But actually, this formula actually extends to the south pole as well. At the south pole, you've got an element which is actually independent of the direction. So it actually has a well-defined limit. And this element has square one. And what happens here is that this element zeta, which is going to be there in any reasonable completion of the enveloping algebra that respects ad invariant, because that's what we use in the proof, is what makes possible the SU2 theory and the half integer spin version. The full details of that haven't been worked out. That's something for Laurent to do. But this element zeta does link up with the d0 variable, because it's not seen by zeta squared. Well, that's okay. That's perhaps not necessary. Di squared is okay. It's not seen by di. But it is seen by d0, it's coupled to d0, so it's linked up with that. And the SU2 Fourier theory, when you try to define it, is effectively, in our paper, described as a 4D theory with an equation that captures the discreteness. And finally, if you accept any of that, what you see is there is a need for an extra dimension, even in this 2 plus 1 quantum gravity where you didn't have a time, where you've already got time. There is a need for an extra dimension. And the central dimension is linked for the passage from SU2 to SO3, and that is coarse graining of the theory. So that is a renormalization group. So that's a step of the renormalization group. So that's a hint that the correct interpretation of this variable in that particular model should be a renormalization group. I'll stop there.